If you're enjoying this podcast, please leave us a review and tap the follow button so that you never miss an episode.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to another Monday. You know what that means. It's time for RFRX, your prescription for coping. I'm your host. I'm Kara, and I have with me here this evening your wonderful and fabulous co-host, Helen, the fearless psychic. How are you?
I am doing wonderful. How are you doing, my friend Kara?
I am doing wonderful as well. Glad to be here. We are already in December. I don't know how this happened. It was like July yesterday.
I was going to put up my Christmas decorations over the weekend, and then I totally got unmotivated to do it because I'm just not feeling it yet. So I'm going to do it next weekend, and I'm going to force some holiday spirit into myself.
I think that's acceptable. It's, yeah. It's still early. I always procrastinate with the Christmas decorations too. And then I procrastinate taking them down. So they're still up for a full month, just, you know, not completely in December. So hopefully that's okay.
Listen, my best friend, he kept his decorations up till May.
Okay, that's a lot.
I was like, why are you keeping it to me? And he was like, well, he goes, it's really pretty and it's adding aesthetic to my house. And I was like, okay.
I mean, that's fair. I had an argument with someone last year about Halloween decorations where I said, you know, you don't want me to put these up yet because it's only August, but here's the deal. I've spent money on them. So if we enjoy them for twice as long, then our value has doubled for the money. So, I mean, you can't argue with that kind of
logic. I have some Halloween decorations that I keep up all year round because I like spooky things. But like, and I went shopping after Halloween this year and I bought a bunch of stuff and I had to like hold back to not put them up. I'm like, you can wait till next year.
Yes. Without any further ado, Helen, would you like to introduce our speaker who may seem familiar to some people?
Yes. So back by popular demand, our speaker tonight is David Teachout. David Teachout is a mental health therapist and photographer focused on and teaching how creativity intersects with mental flexibility to work through life struggles. David grew up as a Christian fundamentalist, attending a Bible college and receiving a bachelor's in theology and psychology. During his studies there, David deconverted and has been on the journey of appreciating humanity and all the stories we create to build a meaning and purpose. David has a master's in both forensic psychology and counseling psychology. And is currently at work on a doctorate in clinical psychology. David has been actively working within the field of psychology as a therapist, social worker, advocate, and subject matter expert for over 15 years. In his spare time, do you have spare time, David? David enjoys a copious amount of reading, both fiction and nonfiction, exploring perspective through photography, and maintains a blog at www.lifeweavings.com and a podcast at humanitiesvalues.com. So I'm going to open the floor to our friend David. Take it away, my friend.
Thanks, Helen. Not nearly as much free time as I'd like, but I did pass my 100 books for the year. So if anybody wants to, you know, start gabbing books on Goodreads, you can pretty easily find me on there. So
consider yourself friended. I'm going to find you.
I'm going to look vicariously through you that you read books.
I set a goal of 100 every year. And usually, granted, I cheat a little bit, like 70% of it's fiction. So a little easier to read. But yeah, so. Lots of fun.
It's not cheating. We'll actually get into that. Audiobooks are not cheating either.
No, they're not. No, they're very much not. No, my wife introduced me to audiobooks years ago, and it's been amazing ever since. So, some of them I can't even read physically, like because the voice is too associated with the story that, no, I can't. I have to listen to it. So.
I'm the same. If the author reads it, like, I'm getting it on Audible. That's just all there is to it.
I'm like that with any Neil Gaiman book. If he's reading it, I'm going to get the book for sure. I'm just going to listen to the audio and just, I want him to just whisper me and send me to sleep at night.
mm-hmm. That's true. Oh, speaking of Gaiman, season two of Yes was approved. So yeah, there is a plus. Yeah.
All right, sorry, we're getting distracted over our nerddom. Okay, do your presentation, David. We talk about our nerddom on the hangout. Yeah.
But I mean, the amazing part is that some of this actually right now is part of what we're going to be talking about. And about what at least I think, in my perhaps not so humble opinion, a more humanistic kind of spirituality is entailed by. So really talking about fiction books and so on and how we create stories together is very much a part of what we're going to be talking about here. So, with that, as was already noted, by all means, put questions in the chat. We'll keep track of them. But as well, if I happen to see one that's extremely pertinent right to what he just said, odds are I'll probably respond, hopefully without actually referencing your name. I've learned. And
we will edit that out.
We'll edit it out. Yeah, we'll edit that out. So by all means, you can put it in there. And then if any don't get to, we'll get to at the end. And yes, I will be hanging out afterwards for the kind of chat. I'll just take a small break in order to grab a beer. And yeah, it'll be good. Yeah. Yeah.
Excellent. So, yeah, I think you might be our champion hangout guest. I think you've stayed.
Yeah. I usually stay about all night. hour and a half or so. It's we have some pretty good chats. So yeah.
That's how you get sucked in, man. Like I have to go to work. I get sucked in.
Yeah, that's tomorrow's problem.
Right. I'm in my office, so it's pretty easy to walk into work. Oh. So yeah, it's yeah. With my nerd background of books. You have to have a nerd background of books.
I have Pokemon. Yes, so that's my background. I have Pokemon for my nerddom.
That's awesome. So we're going to be looking at, speaking of all the stories that are involved there for Pokemon. Is Pokemon Go still a thing? Like, is that still a game people?
Yes, I know several of our atheist activist friends that are all in on the Poke Cult. So they're all in.
all good. All right. I played it for a short time and then just... it faded.
My ADHD kicked in and then I was like, okay, I'm done.
A little bit of rum. Yeah. So so with all of that, I mean, and that's part of it is the creation of community. We'll be getting all this. And so the topic is definitely going to be a little bit more philosophically minded, but also very much embedded in what we know about human psychology at this point, or at least what I'm aware of, what we know about human psychology. So I'll throw that caveat on there. There's plenty of stuff out there I've not read. And maybe even stuff that I disagree with that, you know, down the road, I may find out that I should have agreed with it. It happens a lot over the years. With that, kind of starting with, so I'm going to be building a bit of an argument, so to speak, of what spirituality is. And then I'm going to offer near the end a type of definition around it. And part of the reason why here that, like, for instance, I asked the questions around, hey, is this, you know, must spirit or soul be inherently religious? And it was great seeing everybody's answers. Thank you, everybody, for filling these out. I love the fact that half... we're on either yes or no, and the other half were on, hey, we make this stuff up, and give me the context first, and then I'll give you the definition. So I have a feeling that people are starting to understand how I ask these questions. So
I think they might be.
They're on.
Do you want me to share the poll results?
Yeah, no, go ahead. Yeah, that'd be fun.
All right, here we go. I will pull it up and I'll read out the results too for anybody that's listening. As David mentioned, question one said spirit or soul is inherently religious. And yeah, pretty even split. 22% said yes, 26% said no, 26% said we make the stuff up, and the other 26% said give me the context first. So yeah, that's interesting. And then we've got question number two. I was interested in that one. I currently enjoy a quote unquote spiritual practice of 11% said journaling, 22% said mindfulness, 11% said internal reflection or humanistic prayer, quote unquote. 19% said engaging in social gatherings, and 37% were not sure. And I know there could have been some people who do more than one, so could be more than that too. And then question three, favorite usage of spirit. 19% said it was anime. I'm guessing this is maybe a Miyazaki reference or something. Put your answer in the chat.
Also the win.
Yes. Hey. 30% said songs. 11% said fantasy novels, and 41% want to leave it alone. And then who's going to win the Georgia runoff election? 52% said Warnock. Okay, we'll see. 22% said Walker, and 26% said the people. So yeah, there's your answers, folks. You heard it here first.
Like, it. Just love send it. Your spirit energy to Warnock to win tomorrow. That's what you want. We are an 501c3 charity. We do not promote candidates. I'm going to put that disclaimer in there.
You may send your spirit vibes to any candidate you choose.
Yes. The spirit, just use the spirit fingers and you'll be all good.
Is that like jazz hands?
It is. It's similar. If you've seen, what was the cheerleading movie with...
Bring It On.
Bring It On.
Yeah.
Amazing movie.
Are we getting sidetracked again?
We are totally getting sidetracked again.
Let's get back on the train.
and so with a lot of these answers, what's really fun with it is that so much of this has exactly to do with how each person is approaching, how we create meaning and purpose. And so I'm going to start with just the baseline a bit of, well, what's a person? Like, what do we talk about when we discuss, like, you know, if we have to start with us, we're not talking about whether or not spirituality as a concept works for aardvarks and cheetahs, although I'm sure it does. It's just that it works, for us in a particular way. And so I'm going to quote a bit from Owen Flanagan's The Problem of the Soul, which is definitely on the list of books at the end that I highly recommend. And he notes that although there are no souls or non-physical minds, no immutable selves, although there is no such thing as free will, there are still, at the end of the day, persons. What is a person? A conscious social animal that deliberates, reasons, and chooses, that is possessed of an evolving or continuous, but not a permanent or immutable identity, and that seeks to live morally and meaningfully. I can actually even copy that and put it over. But yes, Problem of the Soul, well worth reading. It's probably one of the first heavier psych books around philosophy and whatnot that after deconverting and getting more and more into psych, it was super helpful in kind of figuring out, well, I'm gotten rid of this, immaterial supernatural stuff. How do I keep the stuff that I like about it without necessarily bringing along all the immaterial stuff that makes no sense and can't do anything with. And he does a phenomenal job of exactly answering that question. And in some ways, returning the notion of soul or spirit or whatever to the realm of humanism. He is Flanagan, I think he is still alive from what I recall. And in the last time I knew, he was actually he was a teacher at Stanford, I think. And he's an ordained Buddhist monk. In fact, if you read The Problem of the Soul, about two thirds of the way through, he shares a brief synopsis of his biography. And it is, that man has been through shit. He went through his own dark night and he really came out of it. It's a testament to just how powerful his own philosophy is. But part of what we're looking at here then is these, you know, these points here concerning, okay, so a person is fundamentally a social animal. I'm going to harp on that a lot. Fundamentally a social animal that deliberates. So the idea of, you know, trying to figure out stuff, what's going on, decision-making, reasons. Curious there, why is that different than from deliberation? Chooses, which is an interesting word to use, given the fact that two sentences previously, he just noted, or previous sentence, he literally just said that we don't have free will. And that's possessed an evolving or continuous identity, but not permanent. And we're going to get into why that's important, particularly when it comes to how we connect with one another and spirituality from within a materialistic and humanistic perspective. And so with some of that, you know, a lot of this breaks down then into like this idea of personal identity, how we relate to one another socially. You know, we don't, every time we engage with a group, every time we engage with anybody over the, you know, beyond us, I mean, and in fact, could even be said that we're, anytime we engage even in our own internal reflections, that in fact, we are having a conversation with an idea of ourselves. That we're engaging with a dialogue with the person that we believe ourselves to be and would want to be, depending on the context. I mean, essentially ethics. So, you know, the idea here, I mean, ethics is about how we are going to treat one another. How am I going to show up in connection to somebody else and treat them in a principled way? That's ethics. And so in this sense, we're having, before we act on a decision, we're having a kind of internal dialogue to the degree to which, you know, you do before you make a decision, each their own on how far that, how long that lasts. But, you know, we have that internal dialogue around like, well, wait a minute, who is the person that I want to be to show up in this situation? I mean, we're effectively projecting forward and going, oh, okay, this is the future I'm stepping into. How do I want to interact with it? And that's where we act, you know, ethically. And so, you know, it's one of the things that I work with clients about. Total shout out for the secular religious
secular therapy project.
STP.
I just remember STP and I'm thinking something else. Anyway.
Stone Temple Pilots.
Oh, I've not heard from them. I haven't heard them in a long time. Okay. Gonna have to listen to some more music after this. I will be quoting from Tool later. So
yes, all right, yeah. I'm all in now.
There we go. So, you know, but it's one of the things I work with clients around is this notion around how, effectively speaking, all of us exist as fictions in everybody else's head, and the health of a relationship, regardless of what it, you know, what form it takes, is largely contingent upon how flexible we are with how wrong we might be about who this person is, and how willing we are to engage in that dialogue around figuring out how does this person actually see me and how much overlap is there, and can we, you know, bridge this and make it a little bit more so, even though we will never, ever, ever have perfect overlap. I mean, that's the joy of, you know, healthy, growing relationships, is the fact that as you actively engage with each person in your life, you are going to expand on who you believe yourself to be, and then engage and have greater flexibility in how you're going to act within a lot of different situations. So the idea here then is like there we have that social animal that is deliberative, is reasoning, is choosing. So we have, how do I want to be? What is the rationale that I'm creating in order to justify what I'm going to do or have already done? And then what is the behavior that I am choosing within that context to show up as?
You know what it's like to journey out of a once cherished belief. Maybe you were devoutly religious, escaped a cult, or perhaps you simply navigated out of some very difficult days. And now you'd like to help someone else do the same. Recovering from Religion is a wonderful support organization for people who feel confused, troubled, and alone as they come to grips with the possibility that they no longer hold a religious belief, or that they risk losing everything if they're honest with themselves and others about their journeys. These people need our help. and recovering from religion needs yours. RFR is seeking volunteers. Perhaps you're formerly religious, or you have a specific skill set like speaking a foreign language. Maybe you're just a good listening ear. The RFR Volunteer Training Program will help you translate those abilities into critical assistance, encouragement, and support for the men, women, and youth who contact RFR every day from all over the world. You can relate. You can understand. And you can make their journeys easier. Join the team at Recovering from Religion and remind someone else that they are not alone and someone is here to help. To find out more, click the volunteer tab at recoveringfromreligion.org.
To exemplify this person that I believe myself to be. I mean, when we see this, depending on, say, what context we walk into. I mean, we're literally going to be acting differently depending on if we walk into a funeral home as opposed to a hospital, as opposed to a church, as opposed to a family gathering, as opposed to a bar, to our own home. I mean, most of us have zero problem, say, walking around naked in our own home, but we're likely not going to be doing that at just the regular bar. Now, there might be special bars that would include that. That's totally other thing. And so you're certainly not going to do it at work unless you have a really cool job. But, you know, it's very different. And so, yes. So, you know, so we're going to be engaging each and every time. We're exhibiting different aspects of ourselves based on the context. So how do we, why do we do it this way? And that's where it brings us to Anil Seth, and anybody who's probably listened to the last couple of talks that I've given, I've totally referenced this guy multiple times, and I don't care. Because his Being You really is just a phenomenal book and really, really is a must read. But he looks into the nature of what personalized history is. And or what a personal identity is and what it's made up of. And he has four different components. And the first one is personalized history. You know, it's this kind of autobiographical history. It's what we believe, the story we have about the self that we think ourselves is, and that is often unchanging and so on. Of course, as Flanagan recently pointed out, not true. There is no immutable or unchanging self. So we've got a question here as to what this personalized history is doing to us. There's a point at which this personalized history is a lie, but it is a helpful lie. It is a way of limiting the information so that when we engage in a particular situation, that we will do so in a coherent way that other people can respond to. I mean, so think about it for a moment. Like, if we were to try to enter every situation as, you know, people think about, like, I want to be authentic. Why can't I be authentic in every single thing that I do? And we're like, unless we're talking body snatchers, you're always authentic. You're literally impossible to do anything other than be some manifestation of you. It's just that the you here is whatever is called for and that you believe is possible within the social context you're in. So, which can be really, really fun. And,
I have a quick question. Mm-hmm. So is the authentic self, like, because we make active choices for the situation that we're in, do people think the authentic self will just come naturally where you don't have to pick and choose what your interactions are?
I think quite often people use the term authentic as a judgment on themselves.
I see. Okay.
I think it's a trap that we often apply to ourselves when we're either one, unwilling to acknowledge that the actions we did are, that was me. Okay. So instead we come back with, well, that wasn't the real me. I wasn't being authentic here. And so it's a way of kind of, you know, going, the real me is this perfection ideal over here that if only you really knew this person, you know, you would have been fine. So, you know, it's a way of judging ourselves, both giving ourselves a pass, but then it's also judgment in the sense of, well, wait a minute, if I can't be me, then I must be inherently a problem. There must be something broken or intrinsically wrong with me. If anybody's following along, what does that sound like? Oh, right, the doctrine of original sin. I mean, the whole notion there is that you can never be authentic in who you are because who you are is inherently wrong.
Oh, so if the authentic self is basically the ideal perfect self, then you're never going to get there.
Never going to get there. And so authenticity is just kind of off the cuff here a little, but is a little, I think actually a holdover from this, sometimes religious, sometimes just our notion of what the perfect is. Religion just kind of, you know, hops onto that bandwagon for it, depending on its form. Not all religions have an idea perfect, but fundamentalist ones do. And so, you know, so what we're doing is we're using that idea to continue to separate ourselves from self-exploration. So if we can, you know, in some ways we could just jettison authenticity from our vocabulary, I would actually say that would be enormously healthy. If instead we just simply every single time we show up at a situation is go, I'm always me. I'm just recognizing that the me that shows up right now might be a little different based on context than anything else. And that's not hypocrisy. It's simply that we can never, ever show up in every aspect of who we are because not every context calls for it. When we're going to show up at work, we're literally not going to treat the same people there or the people there the same way as we would family or friends or otherwise. We'd be fired. That's why there's HR. I mean, it's like, and vice versa. You know, we often see this in, people, a lot of my clients have to do with relationship issues and how do we, navigate being real with each person. And so much of this has to do with this fear that if I'm, a certain way, then they're going to get rejected and so on and so forth. And the reality is you're always showing up as you, and that's okay. It really, really is. No matter how you dress, speak, appear, present, whatever you want to throw it, you are always you and you're always just fine. The only questions really to ask is, do I want to show up this way in this context? Am I comfortable doing so? Do I want to show up this way? And how accepted am I in showing up this way within this context? And there's not an easy answer in either one of those. I mean, there might be times where you're showing up, it's kind of like trolls, you know, on a chat board in a, you know, public meeting here. It's like, yeah, if you want to go share your cheap porn videos and anything else, to disrupt things, are you being you? Yeah, kind of a douchebag, but you know, that's just part of who you are. And, you know, it's like, but you're still being that. And guess what? If you were to show up and share that in a completely different context on some kind of Reddit forum or whatever, you'd be fine. Everybody would celebrate. They probably ask for new clips because why keep sharing the same one? But, you know, there it is. So, you know,
you are.
Just yes. Go on 4chan. Just do it there.
Although even 4chan has a, was just reading about this, even 4chan has service agreements. Like they have operations as far as like what is and isn't appropriate. 4chan.
Really?
Really? Yeah. What?
I thought it was like the Wild West of the internet.
No, there are limits even there.
What so, are they? Has anyone found them yet?
I want to know the limits.
It does have moderators.
Oh, I so know that. Whole... I know you can't post child porn on 4chan. That is a limit. You cannot do that on 4chan.
Yeah. So I mean, it's so each one of these. So even the supposed wild, I mean, for that matter, the Wild Wild West was not actually that wild. But it makes great movies. So even here, like you have these contexts that we're showing up for and going, okay, what do we want to do? And so, you know, back to, you know, Seth's thing around personal identity, it's like, okay, so we've got a personalized history. And then we've got a kind of thread of autobiographical memories. You know, it's the memories that inform that story of what we have about our history. Now, problem is, memories themselves are constant recreations. So if one of the analogies that I love going with is that memories are kind of like those, actually they're still around, you know, the connect the dot images you do as kids, or if you're really cool adults, you know, it's like you still have these. And now part of what, thank you for the comment. We totally exist. That's awesome. We'll get there in a second. But so part of what's happening there is going, okay, so, you know, memory is a kind of like connect the dots in order to come up with an image. It is not a movie reel giving you a fully realized image that has been saved in its exact form for all of eternity. It's a reconstruction every single time. And sometimes, and we've seen this, and sometimes when we like, oops, I missed the dot. But we can still tend to see what the image is. Like, it's still a giraffe. It might be missing a bit of a nose and the leg is a little off, but you know, I can still see mostly what it is. Welcome to memory. By and large, we still have things that make complete sense, but we're missing pieces or some stuff got added in. And that's totally fine because it's being recalled within the particular moment in which you're at. So a lot of this goes into Shermer and a bunch of others, you know, refer to as like basically epistemic humility. You know, it's like knowledge is probable. It's never absolute. It's never about true and false per se, as much as it is more than likely true and more than likely false. But nothing is ever 100 or zero. And so, you know, all of this is kind of getting mixed up into who we believe ourselves to be and how we show up. And the last two then are a remembered past. So this notion that I did exist, whatever I is, you know, did exist at some point. Ooh, good question. I'll come back to that in a second. And then also a projected future. So in a nutshell, with those last two, basically anytime we're considering what decisions to make and who we're going to be in a given moment, we are drawing from the past in order to understand the present, in order to predict and understand how we're going to show up in a future that is constantly collapsing into itself. So every time we make an action, we are in effect. This goes back to that whole, like, you know, it just recently remade the rounds, or at least the rounds that I saw on the internet around, you know, I forget who initially coined it, but, you know, it's everybody makes such a big deal out of these stories and movies that talk about going back into the past and being, you know, changing one thing, and it's a butterfly effect, and you stomp on, you kill a janitor, and suddenly, like, Hitler won. You know, I mean, it's just like, what the heck? And, you know, you've got these crazy scenarios, and yet nobody applies that same thinking to the present. And that is exactly what, in fact, Simpsons did a great version of that. I think South Park probably did, because South Park's done everything. And some great examples out there of exploring this. But that's just it. That, you know, fundamentally, that is what our brains are constantly doing. They are figuring out what are the ripple effects into a future that I want to create. And what do I want to step into?
So can I ask a question? Mm-hmm. So if you learn a pattern, like through trauma, and you're trying to rectify the pattern, like you want to create a new pattern, but you keep falling into the traps of what you know from your trauma. Is that something you're doing authentically, or is it a result of the trauma that you're trying to have a corrective experience?
So,
I know.
Yes, and. Well, and this does go a little bit actually to the previous question. Around, you know, the authentic self, you're pretending to be someone. So if we start with the premise that you're always you in some variation, because you is a multitude, you know, the old kaleidoscope toy that's, I think, still around is a great example. I love that one. Like, you're always condensed. Like, you can't just, you know, if you break it, you can't create any images anymore. Whereas, but the images that are in there are infinite as far as, you know, all the permutations can be, you know, can be had. Same thing with us. Like, we're limited within our biology and genetics and social constructions and so forth. But within those, I mean, come on, we've just passed 8 billion people on this planet. I mean, and every single one of us is some variation on humanity. Hell yeah. Like, that's just stunning. It's amazing to contemplate that. Like, so people are starting to travel again. So it was just in Tennessee, yay, full excursion. You know, was just in Chicago for, you know, forensic conference. And, you know, you think about for a moment, like, anybody who walks through, you know, a bus station or an airline terminal, consider for a moment that the hundreds, if not perhaps thousands, especially if you're in O'Hare, whew, what a crazy airport, you know, that you're encountering are just kind of brushing by in that petri dish of, right. You know, of airports. You know, it's like, love you, Chicago, thank you. But, you know, it's like you're wandering through this and realizing that if you were to come back the next day, or if you were to come back a year from now, you'd have the same number of people and probably none of them would overlap. Like, how astounding is it? Like, how narrow is our existence usually, that we think this is all there is? And yet the world is so, like, all we have to do is just think for a moment. Like, anytime we go to a mall, anytime we go to a store, the vast majority of the time, especially if we go in outside of our small town, I live in a town of like 3,500, so I literally have to go somewhere else to really, you know, stop bumping into people. But, you know, it's like, is to recognize just how much is out there that is outside of our immediate experience, and how delightful that is, how amazing the possibilities are to be human. And that's what, you know, so we're starting to kind of build a little bit of what this is, a humanistic spirituality is. And so, to get to your question, because I know I totally went on a small tangent there.
That's fine. I do that all the time.
Okay. It's like, so authentic self, you're pretending to be someone. Trauma is in some ways, you know, looked at as you're pretending to be something or someone in order to work through or deal with the, you know, negative experience you've gone through. I don't mean to be dismissive in that language. It's just, you know, defining it there. And it's so that is part of it. But part of healing, if I can use that word there, generally try not to, but, you know, but in healing in that, so part of progress through that to step into the fuller, you know, idea of who you are from out of trauma is, one, we never get rid of it. Brain, once it learns something, it never gets rid of, you know, behavior. So what we're doing is, part of the process is to actually recognize, oh, that was me. I reacted that way. And I had to pull it from somewhere. And I didn't pull it from anybody else because nobody stepped in for me. This was me. This was a possibility that I responded to and with in this context. And that does not mean, back to the kaleidoscope thing, that does not mean that is the whole of who you are. The abuser, the traumatic experience, the fundamentalist, you know, leader or cult leader or whatever wants one thing, and that is for you to define the whole of who you are by this singular event. They never, ever want you to think outside of this. They want you to think that the only authenticity that you have is what you experienced in that moment or with them, especially when it's a cult. Like, oh, dear leader. That's right. The only person. I mean, what was my favorite verse as a believer, you know, was, it is no longer I who live, but Christ who lives in me.
That literally the embodiment. Me out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't like that.
Well, no. Well, in retrospect, no, I don't. But I mean, talk about that authenticity, you know, the real me cannot be me. It has to be this other that is now been given or that I've identified with in this other entity. And so what we're trying to do here is recognize that that principle, that idea is utter and complete bullshit. We are far more than any singular experience, any single expression. We're more than whatever, you know, article of clothing we want to, you know, wear. It's more than how we want to show up for work. We are also all of those things, but we are also more. And we can constantly be exploring what that means. And there's the pluralistic, true, you know, liberal principle of society that we want to build, and we're haphazardly creating through time, and sometimes don't show up very well at all in it. And you know, it's like, is this idea of, hey, you know what, you be you, and as long as it's consensual and you're not actively harming anybody, I don't care. Great. What do you want to show up as? I mean, art. This is why it's so amazing to see, you know, what art can be. Literally just got, told that there was an art exhibit, and I won't say where, because I don't want to give away identifying, but it's like this person was talking about how just showing up and giving us, like, riffing on basic topics was a form of art expression. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, I just kind of thought that was me at a bar. But I mean,
I didn't know I was such an artist.
Artist, wow. I mean, here I am. So it's, but there it is. It's like we're all trying to figure out, like, how do I appear in each moment? And this person wouldn't do the same at a business meeting, or you know, perhaps with, you know, but friends would be maybe different topics and so on. And the struggle there is going, well, I'm only really me over here. No, you're you all the time. That's the amazing quality of being human, is that you're you always. And isn't it, and can it be fun and exciting and possibly freeing, especially when we're discussing the effects of trauma, to be freeing to recognize that I can be more than what this one situation called for. There are a lot of other steps, just kind of noting that's a first, it's an initial way of freeing oneself from this.
I really like this. So that's kind of, you know, bringing it home more for me too, what you were saying earlier about, you know, authenticity not being a great term for describing yourself, because then it would tie you down to this one single idea rather than there being multiple facets and possibilities as well. Is that mm-hmm. right?
Yeah. I mean, why tie yourself to a singular? This is where identities are inevitable. Like, we love labels. we're not going to get rid of these. But any, you know, one of the things that anytime somebody shows up, you know, a real, you know, a real conservative, a real liberal, a real Christian would
a true Scotsman,
a true Scotsman.
Yes, exactly, the true Scotsman. Yes, I mean, all it is. Is a declaration that says, no, I get to choose what is and isn't in this label, and anything outside of it conveniently serving me is therefore wrong or right. And so you're going, and we're, you know, it's not like we're getting rid of language per se, it's just recognizing that, thankfully, hence one of the answers, we kind of make this stuff up, so you know, we have a lot more freedom here than not. And so, you know, why not actively pursue that when it comes to ourselves? Particularly when it comes to, I mean, you know, relationships that have been together 10, 20, 30 years, and they, you know, and how do you, you know, it's one answer that was given by a couple that had been married like 50 years. And one of the answers they give, like, how do you still love each other that much? Because they were just like, oh my God, I love you. No, you just, like, you know, episode of, you know, of Riverdale or whatever. I mean, it's just like, it was crazy. You're like, okay. And so, and they're like, because we're always figuring out more about who the other person is. Like, it was just this dedication to going, life isn't over yet, which means we keep exploring. How fun is that?
I like that. That's nice. Yeah.
Well, and like when you're saying about the authentic self, we were at my virtual support group meeting last night, we had a discussion about perfectionism and mm-hmm. that it is an ideal that it is impossible to meet, because what is perfectionism? And to religious people, it's Christ and trying to be like him and mm-hmm. trying to get there, which is impossible. But if you use the authentic self, when you're just you is the authentic self, how you like what you're describing, like you being you, like how this is me being authentic. Okay. But we tend to use it in that can that language that this is a state to obtain.
Yeah. Well, and you know, so there's a question posed around would perhaps an idealized self be better than authentic? And I think there is a difference in the big difference being is at least insofar as I usually see the word applied. Now, granted, my population sample that I'm drawing from is admittedly, you know, limited and bound within, you know, therapy. So take that with the, you know, the grain of salt. But, you know, but often see it even in, you know, when we talk about, you know, mental health in general, you know, it's like, I want to be the real me. I want to be authentic when we show up. And so often, particularly, you know, on a first date or when meeting, you know, family for their first time or showing up for the job, is instead of getting caught up in authenticity, is to actively step into who do I want to show up as in this context? What is this going to draw from me? And how much fun can I have in exploring that? I mean, there's anybody stuck in a job that you don't want to be, for instance, totally have that come up, you know, in a question and going, okay, how am I going to do this? Yes. I know Helen's been job searching recently. And so it's like, you're stuck in a position that you don't want to be. Well, one of the things you can do is to own that process as much as possible by going, okay, well, how do I want to show up in this? Here's the context presented to me. How do I want to show up? You know, what do I want to do with this? What are some variations, in fact, that I could even do in order to, you know, explore who I can be in this, as admittedly constrained as it might be, depending on the job? You know, you're going to have a little bit of fun with it. I mean, one of the things I love doing with stepping outside of, you know, depression and anxiety is to express yourself differently at home. I mean, literally, you know, Americanized Mexican food wearing a ridiculous, you know, tiny sombrero on your head. Like, have some fun with it. I mean, like, you know, it's like, what do you want to do with, you know, wear funny hats, wear, you know, different clothing, wear a bunny suit while sitting down to dinner. I mean, whatever you want, like, have fun with the expression, even in your own home. So you can see things a little differently. I'm getting a little ahead of myself, but still. And so that actually brings us, since looking at time a bit, but brings it, I told you I was gonna quote from Tool, but this is from their song,
well, now you need to do that. It is. To make me happy.
The concept of being our best self is similar to the problematic as authentic self. Yes, it can be very problematic. And I have to watch myself and how I use that as well. So get to that, back to that. But so this is from Tool song Numa. And it was interesting that, so one of their, you know, chorus, or rather one of their first lyrics, we are spirit bound to this flesh. We go around 1 foot nailed down, but bound to reach out and beyond this flesh, become Numa. We are will and wonder, bound to recall, remember. We are born of one breath, one word. We are all one spark, sun becoming. I love Tool.
Me too.
it's just poetry.
Yeah.
But what's interesting there is even within the lyrics, like recognizing that, and I don't want to ascribe too much philosophy to Tool, but and put words in their mouth. But this whole notion of like, we're bound to this flesh that we're in. How are we showing up? How are we creating this idea of who we are, and in showing up in each new thing? And the idea here is to recognize that, I think in the song at least, they might be looking as a negative that we're nailed down, I think, to that flesh. And whereas really the idea here is that it is that amazing that we have this body in order to experience what we're doing, and that we don't need to step outside of. So this is where this, the idea of spirituality can still exist within humanism, with a singular reality, with a naturalism, is the idea that the manifestations of this don't require the supernatural to be expressive and new and different and fun and exploratory. We don't need to step outside of us to be who we are, because we already are. We don't need to take on, you know, the Christ that is on me in order to become, you know, whatever I want to be. I can do that myself every single time. It's wonderful. Although right now I really want to be a small little kitty cat.
I know, this kitty, I cannot not pay attention to
it. Sorry, I had to pick her up. She's like, she's Bellatrix, you know. Yes. Out of Dune, just to show her off.
Destroyer of worlds and curtains, apparently.
Curtains, yes.
There is that.
She's an agent of destruction, and that's why we love her.
And she is her best self, or I don't, she's herself. Maybe there are other versions.
She's her authentic curtains. Self.
There's I love cats and mythology. So part of this, so bringing it into, say, so Daniel Siegel, in his book The Developing Mind, how relationships and the brain interact to shape who we are, he defines mind, for instance, as a kind of emergency, you know, emergent property at the interface of interpersonal experience and the structure and function of the brain. So little do we know that Toole was totally a neurophilosopher. But his notion here is, again, that kind of interactivity between how we are interacting and being who we are in all our multifaceted lives with the people around us. And as well, constrained still by the physical structure of the brain and by extension on the body that we're in. I mean, this is, you know, it's one, you know, I spent a few years working in a live-in facility with mostly elderly, chronic medical issues, chronic mental health issues, lots of dementia, Alzheimer's, lots of psychosis. Many of them had been kicked out of a number of other facilities due to behavioral issues. We were kind of a last resort. And one of the things that was so troubling was not the moments of hallucination, not the moments of delusion. It was the moments of lucidity. It was the moment where you could step back and go, oh, this is what I lost. And now that's an extreme example, but it is, I think, something that we can draw back from in smaller ways to issues of what happens at the depression and the uncertainty that results from, for instance, trauma of any kind. When we step outside of our ideological past, you know, and those of us who are in various stages of deconverting and reshaping who we believe ourselves to be from out of our religious past, is that notion of what have I lost when I was caught up in fill in the blank. What do I no longer have? Now, outside of organic deterioration, where it concerns like Alzheimer's and dementia, the powerful point here is that we haven't lost nearly as much as we get trapped into thinking. That it actually is still able to explore any number of things. That we can still walk into and go, right, I can still be XYZ. I can still be this. Just because I may have been trapped in one moment does not mean I have to be trapped for the rest. And that's whether or not it's a religious identity, whether or not it's a awful manipulative relationship, of which there are way too many. It's that notion of going, no, you don't get to define me, you know, through this. And just because I wasn't able to show this part of me here does not mean I can no longer share it anywhere else. That in fact, I can build a life that allows me to express all the things that I hid because the context didn't call for it. She goes back to the question earlier around, you know, for instance, sexual orientation and so on, around when you're caught up in a, you know, a social group that doesn't allow for, doesn't appreciate that expression, and you hide. And so there is both a, you know, a point there of you're still being you, but it is a constrained you. And we can either in that moment, particularly if you can't get yourself out of it in that moment, is to celebrate where possible all of the ways you can show up, and then actively pursue finding new groups and activities that allow you to express all the rest of it. Hence why it's been so amazing to see the development of all these groups from afar and online in general, is it actively allows us to be able to, you know, it's like, it was reminded of, you know, in Bible college, you know, there were some, you know, really conservative theological books that you'd have this cartoon where they're like hiding under the blankets in their dorm room reading the, you know, the bad theology book that you're spoiling. And it's the same thing anywhere else. Like we're all hiding in some capacity. And so we can either spend our time getting caught up in, I am not able to hear, or we can actively pursue creating the space and finding the space where we can be who we are in these, in other ways.
Yeah, I love that point too, about like the ability to find new groups and new places and even like new mediums to do that in, like for example, online communities. I just throwing that out there.
Yeah, just for example. Yeah.
We have those.
Maybe 20% cooler.
Still waiting for my last two.
Yeah, well, you know, you had to give your 10th talk in order to get those last it's two. It's 2% per appearance.
That's right. Well, I'll work you with a special badge.
We're on a payment plan here. But no, I had a follow-up question about that, though. Do you feel that... it does kind of differ, like are the possibilities different depending on where people are showing up, or like whether it's in person or online or different kinds of things like that? Like,
yeah, how does that everybody knows about the people who are complete assholes on Twitter, and then you see them in person and you're like, where was that? I mean, you're almost talking body snatchers at times. I mean, there are people that I've met who I'm like,
you're a troll online. Moment?
Like, what the heck? And part of that is, House did an episode. Most, most drama medical shows sometime do an episode where it's like, they've got all their inhibitions taken away from them because of something to do with their brain. And of course, it has to indicate, you know, some egregiously awful behavior. Because as if that's what's waiting for all of us. Like, to me, it's nothing more than the, like, well, if you remove religion, you're going to start eating babies. I mean, it's like, wait, what? No, this is absurd. There's not
having a hard time finding babies to eat. Nobody wants to give me any.
Right.
It's only on solstice, y'all.
That's only on the solstice. Oh, the winter solstice is coming up. So get your babies. Have a barbecue. Yep.
So, I mean, it's the same kind of really bad, and frankly, limiting thinking. I mean, for all we know, we get rid of, you know, a bunch of, you know, our own inhibitions about what we think we should be showing up as. And maybe we all show up as like amazing people, you know, filled with love and light. I mean, who knows? Maybe the Dalai Lama is accurate. And in our fundamental, you know, striving in life is to be happy. I don't know. It's possible. I'd certainly love to explore that story more than, hey, being you means being an ass. I mean, it's just like, really, why, if we get to make all this stuff up, why not go there instead of over there? So, yeah. I mean, it's my rejoinder to every time somebody asks me if I believe in God. Well, I don't, like, which one? What do you want to fill this in with? Do you want to fill, like, I don't care. You use the term God. It's the same thing like soul, spirit. You want to use it? I don't care. It's a word. Words don't really do anything to me. They're just, you know, fluvia of the mind, like whatever. So you want to, what I'm interested in is how you fill that in. Are you going to fill it in with the best, the most, you know, the best that we know ourselves capable to do in the current moment, obviously with the possibility of, you know, evolving over time? Or do you turn it into, you know, power hungry douche nozzles? I mean, really, like, this is, what do you want to do with these things? What do you want to do with these ideas that transcend the individual and bring us together? Do you want us, you want to get brought together at the worst of us? Or do you want to, you know, quote unquote, the better angels or nature kind of thing? You know, let's get poetic and have fun with this. So far more interested in that.
Well, and what it was interesting, you're talking about, like, you know, you show up as you are. Like, I work in a place where I work with people that have brain disorders, so with mentally, physically disabled people, and they're just as complex and complicated as those of us with normal, and I'm using quotations, normal brains. Yeah. They pick and choose the morality. They can be super sweet to you, or they can act like buttheads, you know, and that is their authentic self. So to say that, you know, you have to have this type of brain to make moral decisions is bullshit, because they make moral decisions every day, and they don't, again, normal brain, quote unquote.
Yep. And so, you know, so as we're doing, so part of this then is like, okay, so what are we doing in all of this? What's the impetus behind creating all of these stories, figuring out who we're going to show up as, figuring out morality and what we're going to be doing to, you know, as and with one another? And so, and that is, I think, where imagination comes in. And I want to be careful here on the, because often the kind of context, you know, that we bring in imagination, like, it's fake, it's not real, it's, you know, it's like, it's the imaginary friend kind of idea. And I want to actually push back a little bit on that and go, what the imagination is the capacity for any of us to create connections between any disparate pieces of information. Like, it's really like, how do we get from, you know, the idea of building blocks to skyscrapers? How do we get from going, you know, so there's a book, The Way We Think, Conceptual Blending in the Mind's Hidden Complexities. Not light reading, just a note. So do not leap into that unless you are ready to go through a bit of a slog. But really fascinating to explore, like, how do we come up with these complex ideas around justice and the self? And how do we even, in even more, you know, basic, how do we think about ourselves? I mean, when for instance, there's an example around, how often do we go, that person is reminds me of this other person, whoever that may be? What we're doing is carrying the qualities of that other person that we have in our head and applying them to this, to the person in front of us, in order to help us understand this person in front of us better. Now, sometimes that works really well. Other times it gives us a really false impression. this is where we get into trouble with, for instance, why do I keep dating the same person? Or, you know, how did I not see that they were capable of fill in the blank? And the reason for it is because we're applying other ideas about who we believe people to be, putting them on this person based on various associations, and then running with it. And sometimes really helpful, other times really not. And suddenly we find out, you know, that the person's been, you know, addicted to meth for multiple years, for example. You know, it's just like, but that's all of this, you know, the creation of perspectives, you know, coming back to, you know, Seth's thing around a personalized history, creating a thread of our own memories, considering and creating a past for ourselves to draw from, looking into the future. All of this is based on and utilizing that way of imagination, figuring out, like, how do I connect these pieces together to create something that makes sense to me? And we can create everything from pet rocks to, you know, QAnon. I mean, talk about disparate possibilities there. I mean, but really what each person is doing, or, you know, pictures in the clouds. We're just figuring out, like, how this all this stuff works, and trying to apply it within the situation that we're in order to make sense of how we want to show up as. And so the, you know, so, you know, another example is, which is actually from the book, is, you know, the folder, since most of us are probably on computers, you know, the folders on our computer hard drive, are they really folders? No. They're just digital representations. Yeah. So, but we use the idea of, like, oh, in fact, before, if we remember, like, Windows 95, when you clicked on the folder, it would hop a little bit. Yeah. Remember that?
I remember that. Like, now, oh, I feel old.
And it would, like, tell you, like, oh, you've selected this. Oh, how, you know, this is nice. And then what do you do? It's like you'd pick it up and then you'd move it and put it into another place in order to organize things. Where is that taken from? The actual file cabinet. How do we know which one we pick? Because we pick it up a little bit. Mm. We see that it's different than the things around it. That's imagination at work. Applying a experience in one realm to another so that we understand better how to run something that is completely different than the other. It's why some, you know, games will work really well. It's why some, you know, who's ever tried moving, say, from, you know, like, what's the operating system for Samsung?
Android.
Blanking. Yeah, Android. So, yeah. So it's like anybody who's ever been on Android operating systems for years, and then you try to move to, like, Apple, good luck. Or vice versa. I mean, why? Because they're each fundamentally using different blends of concepts in order to help you navigate the way that they've set up their system. And sometimes it doesn't work real well. The flexibility is gone. We've only learned how to do, you know, this one way. Like, I tried going to Android once. It didn't work.
I think that's
well.
My resistance of using Apple products is because I've been on Android for, like, ever. And I'm like, do I want to learn a new system? And my oldest got a new Apple phone. They're like, Mom, you need to transfer over. Look at all the stuff I can do. And I'm like, yeah, no. Yeah, I'm like, I'll have to learn a new system. And I'm old and lazy.
Yeah, but it is. It's work to be creative and flexible and learn new things. Like, yeah, when you're driving somewhere and, like, the road is shut down and you go, oh no, this is the only way I know how to get there. Like, okay, there's more than one way to get there. I promise you can do it. But, you know, it's easier to be on autopilot. But
like, yep. I don't want to force myself to use my active brain card. That's the thing.
Very inconvenient to have.
Yeah, it
to
is.
Think,
it is a lot to engage that brain power.
Yeah.
Yeah. Although as at one point, it's like, yeah, my Android phone already does too much. And you're going, yeah. It was just the latest iOS. And it's like, here's one of those articles about all the things you may have missed in the latest. And I'm like, I can't even anymore. Like, no, I got this is full. and that's it. Unless this just intuitively happens in the course of, you know, using this thing, you're not gonna, I'm done. This is already too much. But that's where, you know, the what's just totally nerding out there for a moment around like how we carry this process of imagination into our relationships and to how we relate to things, places or geography, and people. So these are the three main categories that we are relating to, you know, to and within, and how we then think of ourselves and going like, okay, so how am I going to construct a meaning to say, well, shoot, who's ever showed back up to say they've been away from their childhood home for a while? And then all of a sudden you show up or you see a house that's even resembling it perhaps. And suddenly it's like floodgates of memories and associated, like everything is just right there. And we find ourselves gravitating towards behaviors that perhaps we may have done or thoughts that we may have done, you know, had before. I mean, this is one of the things that really I'm always trying to be very careful with people who are, you know, working through trauma, working through out of habits that they no longer want to do, is that once the brain has learned something, it is never going to get rid of it completely. So if you find yourself months, years down the road, you know, acting in a similar fashion or on a behavior that you did before, that you've worked really hard to no longer do, but you find yourself doing it again, it's not some kind of failure. It's not some kind of deep-seated wrongness within you. It's just that here's a result of this particular context, which includes all the stressors and everything else going on, that here's the behavior that the brain decided, yep, this is how it's going to be. Here's how you're going to show up again. And, you know, part of the success to have there is to recognize it as just another iteration of how you are to show up and go, and guess what the next moment means? It's another opportunity to show up as another version of me. Great. Let's keep going. Obviously, it's a lot easier said than done, I admit. Yeah. But, you know, but it is a practice to get into and to actively explore.
Yeah, I really like that though too, because it's like that's something I've been working on lately, is, you know, not getting stuck on the, oh, but then this happened. When we were talking about self-compassion a few weeks ago, it kind of mm-hmm. reminded me of this a little bit, where, okay, this happened and we're just gonna keep going. I like this idea of bringing in this possibility of, you know, flexibility. And
yeah, can you tell my rejection sensitivity dysphoria brain not to do that? That'd be great. That'd be wonderful.
Well, and thank you for that segue, Helen. Because
that sure, that's why I'm here.
I mean, it's just you see, there's that psychic thing going on again.
Yeah, it's my fearless psychic brain.
It's a thing, y'all.
So, you know, so we bring those, you know, those three categories of what we're relating to, figuring out how we're going to show up for each instance. And that is, so we combine, here's how we organize our experiences. Here's the utilization of, you know, through, you know, the utilization of imagination in order to relate and show up. And that's where spirituality is, I think. It's the active engagement by the imagination to remind ourselves we're not alone, that we're not only one thing. And that's where, like, there's the power, I think, of a humanistic spirituality is to constantly remind. It's not a passive thing. It's not some floating entity. It's not some force. It's not some, you know, something caught up in what, you know, whatever. You know, it's this activity that we can consciously engage with that's already happening anyway. But how much more can we do when we try to be deliberate about it? In which we're constantly recognizing, wait a minute, I don't have to be just this one thing. And thankfully, the capacity to be other means that I am not alone in this process, because I'm drawing from everybody and everything and every place around me in order to figure this out.
I really like that. Mm-hmm. Now, in any of the book recommendations that you've given us so far, which I have gotten links for all of, or perhaps other books, because I know you've read a lot this year, including the Book of Joy. I feel like you read the Book of Joy. I read that earlier this year. I'm hearing echoes. Do you have any books or other recommendations for how to kind of cultivate this imagination and creativity that helps mm-hmm. us to see these possibilities?
So I have a few books and some practices actually to get through. So one that I had not put in the list earlier, but Bruce Hood wrote The Self-Illusion. Really fun. I mean, fun, you know, key total way. But you know, exploring that. There was one by Stephen Hayes, The Liberated Self. Is just fantastic. It's really, really well done. And then there was let's see here. I want to get the title right. There it is. By Edward O. Wilson, The Meaning of Human Existence, which is very much his like end of career. I'm just going to reflect on what all this stuff means, you know, kind of book. And it's really, really fun to like, here's a guy who has gotten to the pinnacle of his career and just gone. It's almost like it's almost that Beautiful Mind speech in a way, mm-hmm. you know, where he just gets up and he's like, you know what? All of this stuff is great, but it all falls short essentially of this thing that we have love, like all the mathematics, everything else. And here's this, you know, person in front of me that reminds me of, oh, right, my humanity. Like, here it is.
So before we did this meeting, I was talking to Carr about this. I was watching a therapy video on the movie Up. And that first 7 minutes of just Married Life, and that it was just a little short film about how love is, it wasn't anything existential about it. It was just two people sharing a life, and that's kind of what I'm talking about. This idea of, you know, showing up and being your authentic self and just experiencing life for what it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And there's being humanistically spiritual. I mean, for one thing, I totally come back on the joke that the first 7 minutes of Up is still a better love story than Twilight. But
oh, you know, for sure. Like, 100%.
Right.
Yeah. I have tears every single time I watched the opening sequence of Up.
This is just a review, and my husband and I are my husband's sitting next to me. He's like, it almost got me. And I'm sitting there like trying to wipe the tears away. I'm like, okay, I'm okay.
Every time. Yeah.
Every time.
Of course, most other movies are better than Twilight.
True.
True.
That's true. Yeah. That's true. Yeah. That is not a good example for young people.
It's not.
Put that out there.
It's a great example of.
But if you watch the Riff Trax version of Twilight, like just put on the commentary, it's a completely different movie, and you will thank me.
Wait, what version is this?
Do a Riff Trax version from MST3K. Yeah, you can download it, and it will change how you watch this movie, and it is amazing.
Well, I hope so, because I don't watch this movie otherwise. So, yes, please.
So there are, speaking of movies, so there are some, obviously there are books that you just mentioned, and a lot of others, but then there are practices as well, which, you know, it's like, one I pulled straight out of Alice in Wonderland. I couldn't remember the exact character who said it, but it was like, basically, I try to think of three impossible things before breakfast.
Alice said it.
Okay. Yeah. So, but it's, you know, I mentioned it more like before lunch, give yourself a little leeway. But you know, it's like, it's actively to consider things that are absurd simply because we're too often getting caught up in the habits that we're not even fully aware of the constraints. And it doesn't mean that we have to explore every single idea that comes across our heads. Quite often, they're foolish and ridiculous, and why spend more time on them? But that's kind of the point here of actively participating in creating ridiculous or impossible things, is because it's a way of letting us know, wait a minute, there's a whole lot more out here that I can think and consider, and I don't actually have to pursue it all. You know, one of the fundamental ways for mental health is to recognize that just because I have a thought or an emotion doesn't mean that I have to let it exist for any longer than just the fact that it popped up. That's okay. So another one, read fiction, watch a variety of entertainment, you know, and I do mean variety. I'm terrible at this because I like dark stuff. It was just watching the first episode of the new Willow show adaptation. Ooh, because the movie,
I haven't watched it yet, and I'm super excited for it.
I'm so pumped for this. Netflix is not going to let me not watch this. It's wherever it is that keeps
it's
advertising.
It's on Disney Plus.
Disney Plus,
that's it. Yeah, it knows I need to watch this.
Yeah, it's fun, in my opinion. I mean, some people, I've read a few reviews like, oh, what the heck? And like, yeah, there are some silly part. Like, really, why is this person dressed that way? This makes no sense whatsoever. Like, why is she leaving? Why is she wearing half sleeves? Like, this makes no sense given the supposed, you know, time frame or whatever. Anyway, you know, so, you know, it's the but it's fun. And what immediately struck me is that all the fantasy shows that have recently come out were all really dark, and this one totally isn't. It was playful, it was a little silly, it was a little like, okay, and you're going, I feel a little off right now. It was like that moment when was it the first like 15 minutes of the first Wonder Woman movie, when there are no men? None. There are no male figures in the first like 15 minutes of the movie. And I remember watching this in the theater going, I'm really weirded out right now. Why is this? And it dawned on me like, oh, my brain is so used to seeing a, you know, particular set of, or even the opposite. Like, if it had been nothing but men or male figures in the screen, I probably wouldn't have thought too much about it. And like, oh crap, okay. Like, good to have this experience to get outside of the habits, you know, without drawing any kind of, you know, shame around or anything else. It's just, here we are, we're stuck in the societies we are, and like, now we have to actively try to, you know, express, you know, explore these things. So, but there it is, like, actively look at, you know, books that are written from really different perspectives, that take and have fun with first, third, second perspectives, you know, that explore concepts that are just absurd. You know, it's like this book called Dark Orbit is fundamentally this idea of an entire civilization that was, you know, built, you know, grew up underground, and they have nothing, they don't even see anything. They have no idea what this is. So they build entire concepts of who they are by touch, and so on. It's like, well, it's like that, the Jason Momoa show, See. Like, it gets a little absurd. Still gonna watch the last season because I'm curious where the heck they're gonna go with it. But, you know, there's elements of what it would mean to explore this idea of how we relate to one another if one of our senses is just completely gone. Mm-hmm. And how, you know, how much do we rely on it? How much do we rely on these habits that we've formed? So yeah, have fun, read fiction, you know, go bonkers. And then, of course, remembering epistemic humility, you know, knowledge is only ever probable. So anytime you find yourself going, this is the way it must be, or this is the way this person is. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, somebody mentioned earlier in a comment around, you know, thinking about people who are uncomfortable in social situations or put on airs or a certain, I forget exactly what the comment was. But it's like really thinking through, like, wait, this is, anytime we encounter somebody who is maybe a little off or awkward or is exhibiting certain behaviors, even if they're behaviors that by and large are going, wow, that's really not a good thing, we don't have to agree with the behavior to ask the question, how is this person seeing the situation that they believe they have to show up this way in it? again, we don't have to agree. Like, this is not about carte blanche to, hey, treat people anytime, any way you want. It's not that. But it is a way of, like, what, you know, it's a question around, you know, relationships that I often will pose to clients is, what image does this person have about you that they believe that this behavior is appropriate? How do they think of you and who you are that this must be okay?
I had a discussion with my husband about this a couple months ago. There was a woman at his job that was giving him attitude, and he had no idea where it's coming from. I'm like, and I said, I go, you probably remind her even subconsciously of someone that hurt her. And you are a representative of that person. I'm not saying it's right, you know, and I, because he's usually a very even keel, like kind person, but he just like, I don't understand where this is coming from. And I go, because you can't, because you're not in her brain, you know,
and you never will.
Yeah. But I go, but I, what you're telling me that her attitude right off the bat, I'm like, something about you reminds her of someone that hurt her. And that's why initially off the bat that she didn't treat you with kindness and just like mutual humanist, you know, behavior, you know?
And of course, you know, so last two being definitely looking at time, but, you know, stretching your physical boundaries, like actively exploring new ways of dance, of exercise, of just simply going for a walk someplace where you haven't in a while or never, just to feel something different beneath your feet and see different things than you're used to. You know, I usually refer to it as like, get outside of the four-walled existence that you've gotten trapped into. Just the fact of breathing air that isn't recycled, that isn't stale. Like open up a window for 5 minutes, even though it's cold, like just something to go, there's more to what, you know, than just this immediacy that I've gotten used to. And then of course, lastly, dialogue. You know, so there's, which kind of ties in back to the original kind of Greek meaning behind pneuma, which is breath, and breath being life, and what words are and what we're creating together. And Siegel mentions around, again, from his Developing Mind book, it's like words enable us to communicate across the boundaries of time and space that separate one mind from another. Words allow us to tell the stories of our lives and relate the scientific explorations that reflect our drive to understand ourselves and the world in which we live. There's the power of it. We want to know about mind reading. Sorry, psychic. We really want to know about, you know, mind reading. We're actively doing that all the time whenever we open up our mouths and express the thoughts that are in our heads. That's mind reading. We're actively engaging all the time. We just get so used to it. We're like, I really want to see the real you. Guess what? They're already there. They're right in front of you.
Yeah. This is great. I love that you gave us this list of practices to actually work on doing these things that we talked about. Physical, I need like physical small steps to implement things. So this is great for me. And I love that you gave us permission to read more fiction, because we all need more of that in our lives. I love that. Okay, before we wrap up and go to Q&A, do you have any more nuggets for us that you want to leave us with, or parting words or anything? Oh, there it is.
Yep. Oh, look, there's a
copy
list.
And paste it. There you go. In fact, that second one I didn't mention, but because I hadn't fully written it out yet in my notes. I'm like, wait a minute, what was I going to say? But actually consider alternative ways of coming even to your own conclusions. You know, it's like, is the way that you're defending something you think the only way of defending it? Probably not. Like what are, in fact, sometimes even actively going and finding somebody who perhaps disagrees with you, but can articulate an idea of that you hold really well, just to see how does somebody who doesn't even agree with you articulate this. This is one reason why I like, you know, I'm actually reading, so I subscribe to The Dispatch, which is, you know, David French, Goldberg, many others who are often religious conservatives. They are, but they're far more, they're not fundamentalists, they're not far right. They're the moderates that have largely been kicked out of their own party and, you know, who are actively pursuing, how do we think about, you know, one of the best defenses actually of the recent Marriage Defense Act, I forget exactly what it was called. The Congress was, it just passed the Senate, it's going back to the House, but it's likely
going to
pass.
Respect
for Marriage Act, yeah. And one of the best defenses of it came from David French, who is an evangelical Christian.
Oh.
And so it's like, there are, in, you know, he got a ton of flack for this. He actually was referred to as, "You're not a real Christian." For, you know, defending this was a
logical fallacy.
That's
great,
right.
Response to that as well. But it was like one of the best defenses of this. And it's from somebody who otherwise you think would not be a fan. And he just gave a beautiful, you know, exploration of what it means to live in a pluralistic society and why this is good. It's good, not just for the people who you disagree with, but ourselves, even as believers in his case. It's like, okay, this is good. We want this kind of activity. We want people to be free to express themselves. And it was a great argument for it. But that's just one example of like going out and figuring out, like, even if you end up agreeing with what you did before, at least, you know, exploring different ways of being able to support it. It's going to be a little different and get that flexibility.
I love that too, because then you can really see, I think, if you're believing something or thinking something for good reasons or reasons that you believe to be good or just regurgitating something that may have gotten into your head by some means that you have not thoroughly examined, mm-hmm. which I'm guilty of that all the time. I'm still cleaning out stuff out of my brain that I'm like, what, how'd this get in here? I don't even believe this.
But what you're talking about, Cara, is like I learned in like paganism, it's called a wicked vow. Like it's something you tell yourself over and over again that's real, but it's not. Like, oh, I can never learn to paint. Oh, I can mm-hmm. never do this. And it's just something you tell, it's something you tell yourself over and over again that you're making real, which is completely false. Mm-hmm. So,
and you hear it enough times.
Yeah. You believe, mm-hmm. you start believing it and you got to take yourself out of that mindset. So mm-hmm. I'm not saying I do it all the time. I'm just saying I recognize what it is.
When I love that example of painting or any kind of artistic expression, especially, it's like, anybody can do this. Anybody can be a painter. The question is not whether or not, and that's what we often will stop at, is because we'll then conflate that with a painter or artist of some form in a particular context. It's not true that just anybody will be, you know, the next, I don't know, rap artist of all, or the next Taylor Swift or whatever. I mean, it's like, it's just, no, that's not true. But does that mean that somehow you're not successful in learning how to express yourself in a different way? Like, in fact, oh my God, what was it? Ed Sheeran. There was a small video. He was interviewed by, I forget what late night host, but, you know, somebody's like, you know, he's like, you hear all the time, like, natural talent and so on will just keep you getting. He's like, no. Like, there's very rarely any such thing. And he has a recording of himself many years ago when he had just started learning how to play guitar and was just singing. And he brought it up on his phone and he started playing it. And the host and the guests were like, no, stop. It was so terrible. And he's like, yeah. Like people look at me and they look at the success where I'm at and they don't consider everything that came before and the luck of simply being in the right place at the right time.
Mm-hmm. And also the discipline that goes into it.
Well, and there's the other, like, you have to show up and do the work.
Yeah. And I don't think people think, because these people are very talented, that it just comes naturally, where it's been years and years of training and doing the work and things like that, because they've chosen that for their career. It doesn't mean that you can't do it. You know, like, if you're going to dedicate to learn the guitar 2 hours a night, you have to put that time in. Otherwise, you know, whatever that looks like. And then if you don't get 2 hours a night, you just do a half an hour, that's fine too. Like, don't try to place judgments on yourself, you know, if you don't. But you, like, if you're not going to be Ed Sheeran, y'all, like, or if you get there, that's great too. But, you know, but don't put judgments on yourself for not sounding like Ed Sheeran.
yeah I don't have his hair. He's got beautiful,
he has good, he has beautiful hair. He's a beautiful gender.
He's a beautiful gender. He's a whole gender.
Yeah, but he has no soul.
And South Park reference for the win.
I love it.
Recovering from Religion is a nonprofit organization whose mission it is to provide hope, healing, and support to those struggling with issues of doubt and non-belief. Hope, healing, and support is waiting for you on our website, recoveringfromreligion.org. There you can speak or chat with a trained agent who will work with you through your struggles and doubts, or to help find resources that may work for you. You can also find local Recovering from Religion support groups in your area for the long-term recovery work. Resources specifically curated for those struggling with doubts, disbelief, and trauma can also be found on the RFR website. To connect with a secular therapist in your area, go to seculartherapy.org and create an account. If you'd like to support the work that RFR does, you can donate or sign up as a volunteer on the Recovering from Religion website. It's also a big help subscribing to the RFR YouTube channel, our blog, or following us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Questions, comments, and suggestions can be emailed to us at rfrx@recoveringfromreligion.org. Thanks for tuning in, and we hope you'll be with us next time on the Recovering from Religion podcast.